The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Kurt Benrud with the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Sci-Fi. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
My name is Denise Sepik. This is Phoenix Fate by Anya Au. The woman in crimson phoenix robes stood barefoot on the frozen river, her long black hair streaming in the icy wind. Hairpins and bangles wrought of the finest mutton-fat jade traced a littered path back to the snowy shore. Barely visible against the crest of trees, the glow of festive lanterns from a sprawling estate blushed the evening sky wedding red. Steam curled past the woman's painted lips as she breathed in and out. She took a step forward and slipped to her knees with a grunt, pushing herself laboriously back to her feet. She laughed, shaking out her softened wrists. With her internal energy suppressed by poison, her knees ached fiercely. Not that it mattered. The edge of the ice was just within reach. Streaks of white darted out beneath her feet at each step, the ice starting to crack under her weight. As she took another step, someone coughed lightly behind her. She turned her head, her heart racing to her throat, then dropping back to her stomach. A stranger stared back at her from the bank of the river. An old woman, silver-haired in a plain brown homespun, a basket of herbs clutched against her belly. Not the person she hoped for, or didn't hope for. "Esteemed lady," the old woman said, "your death does not have to be so pointless." Having expected panic or some sort of exhortation, the lady in red glared at the old woman. "Presumptuous. Why get so upset over your husband marrying in a concubine? It's not uncommon for people to have three wives and four concubines, let alone Prince Juan." Princess Juan sniffed. "Does your husband have so many women in his backyard? Did you spend your days fighting for favor, afraid of being poisoned, spending your dowry and your family's influence in his name while he hugs in one pretty new face after another?" The old woman laughed. "He should so dare." Tears welled against her cheeks, only to disappear as they rolled into the wrinkles etched in her skin. "He did not have the time to marry in anyone else. He died building a wall, leaving me nothing, not even his bones." "A wall? Where?" As one of the daughters of the current prime minister, Princess Juan had gone seamlessly from being trapped within her father's estate to her husband's, largely ignorant of state affairs. "Has there been a new corvée? The last one had been decreed by her grandfather." "Come back to the shore, and I'll tell you about it," the old woman beckoned. Princess Juan looked back over the river. "Old woman, what is your name?"
"Meng."
Fitting. No mere commoner would be so insolent. This must be a dream. Princess Juan pursed her pale lips. "A nightmare. One that began when I was 8. A phoenix alighted on the sycamore tree by the yard I shared with my mother, in so doing setting me out as someone with a so-called Phoenix's fate, the fate of a queen-to-be. I was betrothed to Prince Juan the next day. He was 12. He is not the crown prince. No, Princess Juan said with a hard smile. And perhaps if I walk forward a few more steps, he will never be. Don't you think he's prepared for this? You left your yard and bypassed security to come to this cold river all too easily. Die if you wish, but your death will only give those who hate you what they want. Princess Yuan whirled, her red sleeves billowing in the snow as she bared her teeth. What then? I can't demand a divorce. Even were my parents to agree to such a shame, the prince will never let me go. There is no escape from this cage, even were I to go to a nunnery. The old woman dropped the basket beside her in the snow. Do you know why the divine incarnation of the female spirit is a phoenix? She took a step forward, the snow streaming beneath her sandaled feet. An ever-burning bird, one whose display of majesty and beauty requires constant self-immolation. Another step, and the woman's feet began to glow cherry red. Yet it feels no pain, because the fire that lends it its wings is but the smallest manifestation of its rage. Princess Yuan gasped. You're... She let out a bitter laugh. My grandfather's corvée was choosing me your revenge? As the phoenix's sleeves turned into tongues of flame, she whispered, Revenge? No, you were not yet born when the corvée was decreed. I seek change, the sort of change that can only be born from rage. My chosen child, you who now bear a phoenix's fate, is the bottom of an icy river the sole denouement to your fury? How disappointing. As the phoenix rose into the night, it burned the clouds away, forcing a second sunset that chased the brilliant fan of its tail in its wake. When the estate's guards and maids arrived at the river, Princess Juan stood on the bank over a melted patch of snow, her nails digging bleeding pits into her palms. She closed her eyes, let out the breath staggered within her chest, and turned to meet them with a hard smile.
I'm Kurt Benrud. This story is titled Off the Map by Liz A. Vogel. The car idled in the driveway. On the dashboard, the nav box waited patiently, its screen lit with a list of common destinations. There was a keypad for typing in a whole address, but it was easier just to narrow down from the preset options. Oren tapped the nav box. Eventown, it said in its computerized voice, precisely calculated to provide maximum reassurance and instill a calm and focused attitude in the driver. Sunset Grove, it added in response to his next selections, and then 419. Oren selected Guide Me, and when the nav box told him, Turn left, he did. In the passenger seat, Tara frowned. It's taking us up Darren, she complained. The traffic's always terrible on Darren. So request a reroute. Oren shrugged. Tara poked at the nav box. Turn right in 2 miles, it said in response. Oren did. The new route was little better, with red ranks of taillights from the backed-up cars. Tara tapped on the nav box again. Maybe I can get it to take us up Causewell. Warning, Causewell Avenue under construction, said the nav box, still and reassuring. Tara said a rude word and followed it with, We're going to be late. Can't be helped, said Oren, in a tone much like the nav box's. They inched along. Hey, what about that? Asked Tara, pointing at a small side street. What about it? Why don't we try that way? It's not on the nav box. So? It's going the right way. How do you know? It's not on the nav box. I've heard, Tara said, her voice conspiratorially low, that all the best routes aren't on the nav boxes. Oh, come on, Oren scoffed. Everything's on the nav boxes. That isn't. Well, then it must not go anywhere, he said firmly, or not anywhere anybody wants to go anyway. I want to go there, Tara insisted. You do not. You don't even know what's down there. So let's find out. What? Try it, I dare you. You're going to get us lost. How can we get lost with a nav box? Oren glanced aside to see if she was making fun of him, but she seemed entirely serious. Well, the car ahead of them honked at the car ahead of it. Neither moved. Okay. Oren turned onto the little side street. Warning, diverging from route, said the nav box. Yes, we know, Tara told it. In light of her sarcasm, Oren resisted looking at the screen. It would only be showing him the red arrows of a U-turn anyway. The street seemed fine. There weren't any potholes, and there was no other traffic at all. Tall brick buildings lined it close on both sides. The first few had signs, names, and slogans for businesses long gone. As they went along, the signs became fewer, and the buildings were simply blank brick walls. Doors came farther and farther apart, and the few windows were long since covered over. There were no people that they could see. The nav box hadn't spoken since they'd turned, but surely it would have picked up their location and calculated a new route by now. What does the nav box say to do next? Oren asked nervously. Tara tapped it and pulled it loose from the dashboard with a Velcro rip and shook it. It doesn't, she said in a very small voice. What? It doesn't say where to go, she quavered. It's just recalculating. Give it a minute. No, it's not, Tara said and turned it toward him. The screen was a blank gray square. That's impossible, Oren protested, looking from the nav box to the road and back with wide eyes. The brick faces of the building seemed blurred now, the corners of the bricks smudged and indistinct. The road was smoother, without the bump and jostle of potholes and patches, without the rumbling personality of pavement. Up ahead, the view eluded the eye, faded and undefined. Maybe we should turn around. Oren was slowing down, leaning forward in his seat as though that would let him see better, as though there were anything to see. There's nowhere to pull in, though, Tara pointed out. And she was right. The street had become a featureless smear, the buildings subsumed by an emptiness that loomed like walls that weren't there. It was almost uniformly gray as the nav box's blank screen. The view ahead was no better. Maybe if you turn it off and back on, Oren said desperately, nodding at the nav box. Around them, even the emptiness had faded away. There was only gray, ahead, beside, and behind. There was nothing stopping them from turning around now, but there was nowhere to turn around to. Tara hunted for the nav box's power button for a minute, then resolutely pressed it. The grayness was unrelieved and undisturbed. No road, no buildings, no sky. No cars disturbed the nothingness, and in the lost places where the nav boxes showed no roads, there was no one there to care.
The following short story contains words that some readers may find offensive.
I'm Joanna LaForgia, and I will be reading Monster Killer by C.M. DiGirolamo. When the monsters came, my one useful skill was knitting. I made gray mitts to keep my little sister's fingers warm. I made slouchy caps to cover my shorn head, which my father still tut-tutted and sighed over. I made scarves to keep my hands busy so I did not slap away his affectionate caresses. After all the schools and workplaces and shops were closed, they had infested the gutters and eaves of the city's narrow streets. I made double thick hats and mittens and traded them for ration bars and cans of beans at market. I mended things. Why do you treat yourself like that? Why do you do that to your pretty face? Dad asked in his wheedling voice. He grabbed my hands to keep me from picking at my acne scars. He held my wrist too tight. He stood too close. He called me by the name that made me itch in my own skin. I smelled him on me and I scratched and scratched. You'd be such a pretty girl if you let your hair grow back. I wouldn't be. I was hurrying home, hood up, clutching the sack of ration bars, the coverless paperback I'd gotten from my sister tucked into my hoodie pocket, when I saw the boy fighting. One of them was on him, wrapped around him, throat to groin, its many mouths sucking and boring into his flesh. Most people, with one of them that big on them, went limp, their faces taking on the same blank despair their corpse would wear. But he still fought, his fists sweeping and flashing like the fins of betta fish. I could see its third eye, and ugliness welled up in me. So rarely were they vulnerable. It was we who were vulnerable, glancing over our shoulders for their many spread heads, their pinwheeling mouths as they detached from their nests in the rafters and sailed down to wrap us up in their screaming arms. I didn't decide. I didn't choose. I was just suddenly there, my number 10 straight knitting needle in my balled fist, and I plunged it into the eye, in and out and in and out, like fucking. And I was shouting, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. When it was dead, I peeled it off, but the boy was already dying. It had eaten part of his guts. Untended, he'd bleed to death. Tended, the infection would take him. I liked the looks of him, his hair a burr of dark fuzz, eyes bright, even as his guts leaked onto the pavement. He looked like the kind of guy I wanted to be. He looked like he'd have been a good friend. I looped his arm around my shoulders and helped him sit up. We shuffled back against the skeleton of a junked car.
Thanks, man, he said, his voice breathy with pain. Some badass moves you got there, monster killer.
Thanks, I said. The number 10 was covered with ooze, but I spun it in my fingers and he laughed.
I got some buddies, monster killer, he said. Bring him my shit.
Dad would be worried with me getting home so late, and I didn't like what he did when he was worried. But the boy was dying. Sure.
You keep my jacket.
It was a leather jacket, the elbows rough with asphalt burn, the inside lined and warm.
Give Penny a hug.
His buddies were a few kids in the back of a van. The littlest cried when I told them what happened. The oldest, the girl, took the knapsack and wouldn't look me in the eye, putting an arm around the littlest, talking softly to them. Benny, the middle one, accepted the hug. His wide eyes looked like my sister's. His hands were chapped and cracked with cold. I gave him my last pair of mitts. The girl looked at the mitts and me and at the knitting needles sticking out of their dead friend's jacket. If you want to come with us, we could use a monster killer, she said. I thought they could use someone to mend their clothes. When I got home, Dad pressed me close and snuggled his nose against my cheek.
We were so worried, baby girl,
He frowned at my new jacket. At the way its thickness meant, I couldn't feel his fingertips on my skin. "That looks dirty," he said. "Take it off." My fingers closed around the cool, smooth metal of my number 10. My little sister was in her room, shaking, her clothes rumpled, staring at the wall. "Hey," I said, "get packed. We're leaving."
"But, Dad," she said.
Her voice quavered. But as she took in my new jacket, the way it broadened the line of my shoulders, the way I stood more easy, more confident, her eyes grew brighter than they'd been in weeks. Would they be as bright as the dying boys when they were the only thing to fear? "It's all right," I said, and spun my number 10, still warm with the heat of flesh. "Your big brother is a monster killer now."
I'm Denise Sepik, and this is Spellbones by Anne Leonard. Robert gives me a key to the workroom and tells me to keep the door locked. The book I usually copy from has been replaced by a single paper with a complicated spell that will take me days to ink. The bone is a human shoulder blade, and the spell is for death. I have ink spells for sickness, for cheating, for delayed shipments and stolen funds, but murder is going too far. "I don't want to kill anyone," I say. "You no more kill anyone than a blacksmith who makes a sword does. But if you truly object, you can quit with no hard feelings to you." Robert is the assistant to our employer, Arthur Fossey, a rich industrialist. It was Robert who hired me away from the factory where I was one of 100 women inking the same spells onto bones over and over. A spell bone breaks when it is used. There is always demand for more. I worked for hours each day, straining my eyes and hurting my back, breathing the fumes of the cheap ink. At night, I went home to a miserable, dungy room where I slept on a mat and ate thin potato soup. I see it, the room, the factory, the constant filth, the dim light. I remember my chapped hands bleeding from working in the cold. The counters, who cut pay in half if quota isn't met. I can't go back to that. I can't. "All right," I say. "I am only inking the spell." The death spell takes a long time. I want it to be beautiful. My workroom is high-ceilinged, well-lit with a window that overlooks rolling parkland and a stand of trees, bright now with spring. Since I came here, I have discovered I am an artist. My spells are not just inked. They are illuminated like old manuscripts. At night, the death's spell image dances before my closed eyes, crimson and black against white bone. Gleams of silver, stormy purple, peacock blue. A curving, graceful, intricate tangle of lines. I trace it with pencil until I get it right. My brush strokes have to be small and perfect. Robert checks my progress daily. He is encouraging, cheerful. I am a little bit in love with him, though I am too bashful to act on it. Finally, the spell is finished. Robert compares the pattern to what I've inked, then throws the paper into the cold fireplace and lights it with a match. it shrivels into ash. Very good work, he says. The last of my guilt eases. He touches my hand. None of Fosse's competitors die, and by autumn I have almost entirely forgotten about the spell. Robert and I are lovers, each night a different kind of sweetness. I ink spells for health, strength, happiness. In my free time, I walk through the estate or read books with crisp new pages and soft leather covers. I am full of new vitality. Robert never stays after I fall asleep. One night, I sleep very soundly and waken late to commotion in the house. When I come down, I am told by a weeping cook that Fosse has died, unexpectedly in his sleep. The will is read. Fosse leaves a very large sum of money to Robert. I retreat to my room and stare dried-eyed out the window. When Robert knocks on my door, I numbly tell him to come in. "We can get married now," he says. I still love him. My heart is splintered to the marrow. "I can't," I whisper. He stares. Then he kneels beside me and takes my hand. "You think I killed him," he says. "I didn't. I swear it." He is impassioned, convincing. And if he killed Fosse, I inked the spell. I am complicit. "No lies," I say. "I can show you the bone," he says. He never used it. I let him take me down to Fosse's study, where he unlocks a desk drawer. Inside it, wrapped in linen, is the bone I painted. The pain goes out of me, and I collapse against him. "How can you love me when I have such suspicion?" "It's understandable." I look at the bone again, remember the image that I copied. The lines and colors are not quite the same. I think of the factory, my nights shivering under a thin blanket, the feel of my own bones against my skin, the unabating loneliness. "I love you," I say.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.